If you like your ladies wild and feisty, you have come to the right place. I'm Jody Ambrose, author of Sex, How to Get More of It, and Intimacy, How to Get More of It, and there's nothing I'd rather do on a Monday night at 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern than tune in to the amazing ladies of Cougar Chat Radio. Enjoy the show!
Well, welcome everyone to Cougar Chat Radio. It's Monday, April 15th, 2013. I'm Jen in North Carolina, and I'm joined by Julie in Virginia. Miss Julie, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. You sound a lot better tonight than you did last Monday.
Oh, well, that's good.
Now that you have a headset. Yay.
Yes, so. Exactly.
Well, please find us on Facebook and Google Plus as Cougar Chat and on Twitter at Cougar Chat Radio. Email Jennifer at CougarChatRadio.com if you want to be a sponsor. You can go to our website at CougarChatRadio.com to learn more about us and see upcoming shows and buy merchandise. We have some rockin' new t-shirts. For you gentlemen who thought the Cougar Chat t-shirts were too feminine, we do have Cougar Bait t-shirts for you with a nice, you know, claw down the middle of the shirt. It's kind of cool. And if you're a musician, you can contact us to feature your music on air. Just email Jennifer at CougarChatRadio.com for details. So, Julie, how was your week?
Oh, good. Very busy. Just, you know, working my butt off and, you know, but still trying to have fun as well, you know, as much as I possibly can.
Good.
Yeah.
Good deal. Well, I'm jealous that you're with, you know, Nan, our other co-host, and Miss Andrea, our entertainment correspondent. Tell them hello for me.
I will. I will. We're going to have fun tomorrow. We're going to go to some local vineyards.
Oh.
Yeah.
Not jealous.
Yeah, have a nice little picnic lunch. It should be fun.
Well, good. Well, tonight's show, for you Beatles fans, I know there's tons of Beatles fans out there listening. Tonight we welcome the rock and roll detective, Jim Birkenstadt. We'll talk to him about his new book, The Beatle Who Vanished. The book is about drummer Jimmy Nicol, who filled in for an ailing Ringo Starr. Jim's credentials are quite impressive. He was dubbed the rock and roll detective by many of his clients. He spent a lifetime researching, writing, and consulting in musical history. His books on the unreleased recordings of the Beatles and the making of Nirvana's seminal album Nevermind are critically acclaimed. He's appeared on CNN, Access Hollywood, Much Music TV, CBS, and ABC, and has served as a consultant to the Beatles, George Harrison, the Traveling Wilburys, the band Garbage, Mary Elena, a.k.a. Mrs. Buddy Holly, and major labels like Capitol Records, Apple Corps, Jordan Records, Resort Music, Geffen Records. As founder of Rock and Roll Detective, LLC, Birkenstadt's firm offers a number of specialized and confidential services to music artists, record labels, music download sites, TV and film productions, auction houses, and museums. You can go to rockandrolldetective.com and thebeatlewhovanished.com for more information. So, yeah, he's got quite the bio. So we look forward to talking to him. But before we get started with our guest, I do want to give my sincere condolences to everyone who was impacted by today's tragedy at the Boston Marathon. The White House is, of course, confirming now that it was an act of terror, but we don't know if it's domestic or foreign, and our hearts and prayers go out to everyone. Horrible. Just horrible.
Terrible, I know. And I'm a Massachusetts native, so it really hit really close to home for me. So, absolutely, thoughts and prayers out for everyone involved.
Yeah, definitely. And anyone I know who was an avid runner and a marathoner, I immediately contacted. And anyone that I knew, fortunately, was not there, but they did have friends there, so they were, of course, trying to get in touch with their loved ones. But apparently, I guess they cut off cell phone coverage. You could text,
yes,
and you could tweet and you could do all that, but you couldn't call.
Right. So. Yeah, there were just too many people trying to get through. And fortunately, my friends and family were safe. But at the same time, it doesn't make any of this easier or feel, you know, much better.
Hello?
Anyone there? I don't hear anything. I'm going to have to call back.
Thank you.
Hello, and I am sorry. I'm not sure when we got disconnected. So for those of you listening, I apologize. We were just simply talking about our guest who will be calling in, Jim Birkenstadt, the rock and roll detective, and we'll be talking about his new book, The Beatle Who Vanished, Jimmy Nicol, the drummer who filled in for Ringo Starr. And one of our friends and star of Haunting Evidence from True TV, Patrick Burns, will be calling in. So, Patrick, if you're listening, I apologize. Please call back, and we will take your call. So, where were we?
Oh.
I have no idea where we dropped. Thanks a lot, Blog Talk. All right.
Anyway. What happened in Boston, Megan?
Oh, and what happened? I'm so sorry about what happened in Boston. Absolutely. Well, today's tax day, and to help out, you can Google free stuff on tax day to get coupons for some free and some, you know, for money off items like cookies, Cinnabon, movie popcorn. So every little bit helps, I guess.
Yeah.
But, and also, a newlywed bride discovered she's allergic to her husband's sperm.
Oh.
You
wow.
You think it wouldn't take that long to figure that out.
Thinking they must have been waiting.
They did. They waited until marriage.
I see. Wow, that's really unfortunate.
And apparently
really?
this condition hits 20 to 40,000 women.
Wow. I mean, is it just some? Is it her husband in particular, or is it any man that she would be allergic to?
Just this man.
Something about him.
Yes, in this instance, yes. Mm-hmm.
So maybe this is, a good cause for promoting sex before marriage. You know, just to...
Isn't that awful?
Yeah. Maybe it's not so good to wait.
No. Well, we do have a caller. I believe it's our guest, Jim. Let me get Jim on the phone. Jim, is that you?
This is Jim.
Hi.
Is this Jen?
Yes, it is. Welcome to Cougar Chat Radio. You're on with Jen and Julie.
Hello.
Oh, hi, Julie. This is Jim Birkenstadt, and it's great to be on your show.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Well, let me welcome also our fill-in co-host, Patrick Burns.
Hey there.
Patrick, hey. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, no problem. My pleasure.
Thanks so much. And I'm sorry we got dropped, apparently. I don't know if it was Skype or if it was Blog Talk, but we got dropped, so I had to call back in. But,
yeah, no problem.
Well, Jim, Patrick Burns is on with us. He loves the Beatles and is excited to be part of it. So let's
Great.
Just get started.
Great.
Yeah.
Thanks, Patrick.
So you...
Hey.
You have a new book,
yep.
The Beatle Who Vanished. First of all, let's kind of go back a little bit. Back to the 90s and talk a little bit about how you got started and how you became the rock and roll detective.
Wow, there's a long story. We ought to write a book about that.
<That's> okay.
Well,
you have quite the bio.
You know, I started off writing articles about rock and roll and the Beatles for magazines such as Goldmine, Musician Magazine. There was another one there that was like a CD magazine. So when CDs were really popular, they would have all these interesting articles about rare box sets and things coming out. Anyway, so I did a lot of freelance writing. I wrote a book called Black Market Beatles, the lost recordings of the Beatles. That came out in the mid-90s, and I think Apple first became aware of me, the Beatles company Apple, from you know, seeing some of the rare recordings that I was writing about in that book. A little later on, with the help of producer Butch Vig, who in fact recently just produced a song with Paul McCartney and Nirvana reunited. Butch Vig had produced the album Nevermind by Nirvana, and I was fascinated by the idea of writing a book of behind the scenes of how an album was created from start to finish and what the impact of that album was on a generation. And so I co-wrote a book called Nevermind Nirvana with a lot of help from Butch Vig, and of course he opened the doors to Nirvana's management and Geffen Records and things like that, so that was very helpful. Then, I don't know, around the late 90s, I heard that George Harrison was working on a re-release and remastering of his album All Things Must Pass, and I just sort of got a hold of a number of someone who was his personal assistant, and I sort of volunteered myself, and they took me up on it, and I've been doing a lot of projects for George Harrison and the Beatles ever since. Most recently, I served as the historical consultant on Martin Scorsese's HBO Emmy award-winning film, George Harrison, Living in the Material World. And that was a great honor.
Incredible.
Yeah.
That's kind of it in a nutshell.
Well, Jim, how many songs out there are unreleased from the Beatles?
The Beatles?
Just a handful, dozens?
I would say quite a few. But, a lot of them are the same titles, but you might look at the fact that they might have played the same set list for an entire year in concert around the world. And during that time, a lot of I Saw Her Standing There's and that sort of thing.
Yeah, alternate takes, right?
Yeah, there are alternate live takes. There's radio performances. There's tapes from TV appearances. And then the studio alternate takes and outtakes. And the difference being an alternate take is like take 7 of a song they're working on, and it's not the finished take. And an outtake is a recording that just was left off an album and never released. And then there's demos, too. There's the Beatles, say, at their home with an acoustic guitar or a piano working on a song that they would then bring into the studio. So there are probably hundreds or potentially thousands of songs out there that a lot of people have never heard.
Wow. Do you have an impressive list of clients? Very impressive.
Very. I'm in awe.
Yeah. And I know you probably can't say, but who's been the most difficult to work with?
Most difficult?
If you can say. Yeah.
Most demanding.
Probably not a good idea to answer that question, but I'll say this.
I was trying to ease you into it.
I'll give you a clue without telling you the answer. It was someone who is not at all associated with the Beatles, and it was someone who was associated with a 1950s singer. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay.
Little clues.
Interesting. Because part of my my preparation for each Monday night show is to come up with some, a few current events. And one of the current events that we didn't get to was a list of the most hated celebrities.
Wow.
There's plenty of the world's most hated celebrities, including Chris Brown, Taylor Swift, Lindsay Lohan, I was just curious.
Well, I don't know that I'm going to come on and participate in that one. I'm all about positive positive vibrations and
absolutely
cheerful discussion about Jimmy Nichol, the Beatle who vanished.
Absolutely. So let's get to it. Who is Jimmy Nichol?
Jimmy Nichol was an amazing drummer who started in the 1950s in just in coffee shops in London, and he was a drum repairer, and that's how he would hear about jams and gigs or that somebody needed a drummer for a band. And he was always the first to show up because that's sort of the place where all the gossip goes on, at the drum repair shop. Mm-hmm. And he started out with a band called Colin Hicks and the Cabin Boys, which were sort of an also-ran group from the first generation of British rock. But it did give him the experience of being able to travel to Italy and tour with that band and also make his first professional studio recordings over there. And so he proceeded to climb the ladder in London from one band to the next. And not all of them were rock bands. He was even in the Cyril Stapleton Big Band and the Oscar Raven Big Band, which were definitely moves up for a drummer. And he was able then to learn many different styles of drumming, rock and roll, jazz, R&B, ska, which was like an early form of reggae, jazz. He just was he was like a sponge learning all these great styles. He would buy lots of records at the record stores and listen to his favorite drummers and try and learn from each of them. And so his last sort of big band gig led him into studio recordings, which were a very elite club back then. It was very, very hard to break in. But in January of 64, he was able to break in because the trumpet player from the Cyril Stapleton Band had gotten a job as an arranger. And someone approached him, interestingly enough, to do cover versions of the top six hits of the day. And every month they would want to put out records of the songs they thought would be the next top six hits, copy the sound, and basically rip off the big hits of the day and then fool the kids into buying these 45s instead of the correct ones. And it worked for a while. The most amazing thing, though, is that the top hits of the day were mostly by the Beatles. So in the first quarter of 64, Jimmy Nickel was able to learn all of Ringo Starr's parts, which would come in handy about, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 months later.
Wow.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So how did he land the Beatles gig?
Well, he was playing with a band called Georgie Fame and the Blue Flames, and they were sort of the big live band in London at the time. And the Beatles, the Stones, the Who, all these, you know, big names at the time, would actually go to the Flamingo Club to see this band play. They were, like, very popular. So Jimmy had become the drummer in early May for that band because their other drummer had gotten ill. Jimmy took over, so he was doing studio work during the days and playing late nights with Georgie Fame. And Ringo fell ill one day at a photo shoot at about 11 in the morning and had to go straight into the hospital. It was tonsillitis. And he would stay there for about 12 days. And the tough thing was it was the day before the first day of their world tour, of their first world tour. And nowadays, because of contracts and the way law has advanced, nowadays you can cancel tours and say, well, we're postponing it. We'll be back to your country some other time and no harm.
Right.
Back then, it was the show must go on, or you, the Beatles, and your organization are going to pay all of our damages. All the tickets were sold, all the posters were created, all the newspaper articles were ready, all the records were in the stores, all the lunch boxes and fake Beatle wigs, and this was everywhere from the Netherlands to Hong Kong to Australia and New Zealand. All the security was purchased, all the hotel rooms were ready, all the transportation, and there was no turning back. And the problem was George Harrison, who was very loyal to Ringo, said, well, we're not going out. If Ringo's not in the band, we're not the Beatles. I'm not going.
Yeah.
And so now you had two Beatles not going, and it was a tough
problem.
Yeah, it was a tough deal. It was a lot of inner turmoil because Epstein had to convince John and Paul that why they had to do it, and then the three of them had to convince George. And George had a really funny quote in the anthology movie. He said, you know, I still don't understand why we had to do this, but it was like, how many Beatles does it take to screw in a light bulb? Four. So George did end up going along with it, but he wasn't too thrilled with the idea. And once he did go along with it, he and the other Beatles were very nice to Jimmy Nickel. But anyway, Jimmy wasn't even the first person they turned to.
No.
He was actually the third person in line. And I'll leave it to the readers to read about why that happened and how it turns out that Jimmy was finally called. But apparently Paul McCartney called Georgie Fame when the decision was made to invite Nickel. And Georgie said, yeah, you can borrow my drummer if he passes your audition. And he came down to Abbey Road and he flew through a 20-minute set with the Beatles. And the Beatles were just flabbergasted because he knew all of Ringo's parts.
Because they didn't play them.
He was the right size. He had to wear Ringo's stage outfit because there was no time for a tailor.
Funny. I didn't think about that.
So all these sort of stars aligned for him to have this amazing experience.
A question. Now, did when they did these shows with Jimmy, were the fans in the audience, were they told, hey, that's not Ringo on stage, it's a stand-in for tonight, or did was anybody aware of that?
That's a great question. And the NEMS, which was Epstein's company, tried very hard sort of publicly to create this impression that it was still the Fab Four with Ringo. And if you look at things like newspaper ads to sell tickets and posters and things, they all have Ringo pictured. However, and this is something that I think is a real credit to the other Beatles, from the bootlegs, you can actually hear John or Paul introducing Jimmy Nicol and saying at the end of the show, they'd wait till the end of the show, but they'd say, you know, but we've got one more song, but we just want to say we're sorry Ringo is ill, and we'd just like to, you know, everyone please give Jimmy Nicol a great hand. And they'd give him a huge hand, and this was the first time many of them realized that that guy way in the back with the Beatle haircut wearing Ringo's outfit was someone else.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So did he look a great deal like Ringo then?
I would say no. I mean, you know, his facial structure is different, but he was able to fit into Ringo's outfit and coincidentally had started to grow a Beatle haircut just because he had seen, of course, the Beatles in the newspapers and thought that was kind of a cool style. And so he had started to grow the Beatle haircut about a month or so before he was called to take over for Ringo.
But of course, he's hidden way in the back behind the drum set, so it's from a distance, sure. I'm looking at a picture right
Good
now
point.
on Wikimedia of him doing a set mm-hmm. with John, Paul, and George. And in the background, if I didn't know any better, I'd say, sure, that's Ringo.
Right, right. Well, that's one of the things I tried to do with this book, The Beatle Who Vanished, is to provide a lot of photos of Jimmy, especially during that time that he was with the Beatles, but also the rest of his career, because I do think that pictures are worth 1,000 words, and especially if you place them in the book at the point in time where you're writing about an event, and then people can see that event right there. I just think it adds to the whole reading experience.
Interesting. I of course knew that Ringo on that tour had a stand-in for a brief number of shows. It was a guy named Jimmy Nicol. I wasn't aware that he just sort of faded into obscurity after his very brief stint with the Beatles, and I read that he had hoped he could kind of cash in off of his notoriety, but when the gig was over, he was very, very quickly forgotten.
Well, that's pretty much the story that you'll read on the internet, because the internet mm-hmm. is the internet. Don't believe
right.
anything.
Mm-hmm.
What I found...
You mean you're not a French model, Jim? You're not a French model?
No, I don't even think I know a French model. But, you know, I think what happened was at first when he came back, he was the coolest guy around because the Beatles were still long gone on the other side of the world. All of
right.
the media attention had been focused on him back in London as, quote, the fifth Beatle. That's what they were calling him in the news. And
right.
everybody wanted to interview him. At the same time, he already had a record deal and a group called Jimmy Nicol and the Shub Dubs, which is not a great name.
No,
but
<that's> not.
in interviewing the Shub Dubs and then finding out more about what went on, they had a lot of media attention right at first. The first thing that came up was Jimmy's band got to sub for 2 weeks as headliners at a big Winter Gardens show in Blackpool, England, and they were subbing for the Dave Clark Five. So that was a really big gig. It paid a ton of money, and it brought even more media attention to Jimmy Nicol because it was a good performance each night, and it was well-received by the audience. From there, they released a couple more singles. They were on Top of the Pops TV show the same night as the Rolling Stones, and
wow.
they toured England. So they were kind of a big deal for a while. But then Jimmy made the decision to go back to Denmark, where the Beatles had been. And once they were sort of out of the country and they were touring around Denmark, it sort of, you know, as is natural, the halo of that 15 minutes of fame for anyone starts to fade away. And when that happened and he came back to England, the gigs, the shows that they could do were in much smaller and smaller places until finally in December of 64 they were just doing little pubs. And that didn't pay the bills for those other guys, so they all said, we're leaving. We have to go back to doing session work so we can live. He formed one more band in 65 called The Sound of Jimmy Nickel. And then I think that's when the slide occurred, where he went bankrupt. He spent all his money, and these records never hit well for him. The gigs dried up. The bands left him. His wife divorced him. And he was basically unemployed, back at home living with his mom. And so within 1 year, he had been the prince of pop, and now he was the pauper of pop in just 1 year.
Wow.
And so it's like a real roller coaster. And, that's really the interesting thing is you don't have to be a Beatle fan, really, to appreciate The Beatle Who Vanished as a book, because the real theme of this book, it's great for Beatle fans, but if you're not a Beatle fan, the theme is really, how does someone who's 25 years old deal with 15 minutes of fame for the rest of their life?
Yeah.
That's the interesting thing that I discovered from researching. He did pick himself back up. He did get another important job that took him to Sweden, and the interesting thing was this was the first time he disappeared in the fall of 65. He just walked out the door, didn't tell anybody where he was going, and a lot of the people I interviewed in London never saw him again after that point in time. He simply vanished. And it's funny because those are the words of the people I would interview. They'd always say, he just vanished into the night. So next place I found him was in Sweden. And he toured with a band there that was an instrumental band for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
They saw the whole world, which he loved to travel. They recorded 5 albums. And he was a full paid and full member when it came to creative decisions. And the Spotniks were very generous to him because they would always put him up front in all the photos and things.
Sure.
Highlight him. So he had like a whole roller coaster life, which there were some real ups and some real successes, but if you just look at, you know, Wikipedias or some of the things online, you just don't get a true picture because they make up stuff when they don't know
it. Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
And it's difficult with Wikipedia because anybody can edit those pages.
Right.
Brings me to a point I want, or a question I wanted to bring up. I was just kind of brushing up on my Jimmy Nickel history before I was asked by Jen to fill in tonight. One of the things I read on the Wikipedia page, it said that he was initially going to be offered £2,500 per gig, and John Lennon made a stink about it, said £2,500, he'll go crazy. Give him $10,000. Is there any truth to that?
Well, John made that comment, and it wasn't going to be $2,500, I think, for per gig. I think it was more like he was going to get $2,500 for the whole week, and then John made that crack while they were in a meeting with Brian Epstein after Jimmy had passed the audition.
And sure.
From everything I could find, it looks like he got $2,500 for the week, and then was given a bonus at the end of another $2,500, which would add up to £5,000. And then in addition to that, Brian Epstein had a beautiful gold watch engraved that was to Jimmy, thanking him for his services, and it was engraved and signed by Brian Epstein and the Beatles. And it was a nice gift, and I think it was sort of meant tongue-in-cheek, because both in England and in America at the time, a gold watch is something that you would give a person typically for his lifetime of service at a company right before he retired.
Retirement, yeah.
So I think it was both a sign of respect, but also kind of a tongue-in-cheek sort of thing.
Yeah, that it's over. It's over for
him. It's over, yeah.
Exactly.
And, that watch, which I just have discovered more information about that I'll be writing about soon, the watch became a symbol for Jimmy of what became, at least in his mind, his anger and disappointment with the way things ended after the tour. He got into arguments with Brian Epstein and then later blamed Epstein for some of his failings with his solo bands. And I'm not sure I really agreed with him on that.
No.
I couldn't find any evidence of that, but he Jimmy liked to use the term blacklisting, that he felt Brian Epstein had done that.
I find that very hard to believe. I mean, it's an amazing gig, and he had to realize he was a temp, you know?
Right.
Replacing Ringo Starr.
Right.
Right.
And Brian Epstein had a lot of better things to do than to go around blacklisting a drummer.
Of course.
You know, he didn't have to do anything except move on because he had the Beatles and the Pacemakers and all these other groups in his stable. And he wasn't that way. I talked to Tony Bramwell, who's still alive. Tony was Brian's assistant at the time, and he said, couldn't be further from the truth. He said, Brian Epstein never blacklisted anyone in all those years I worked for him. And he said, why would we? We all appreciated that Jimmy filled in and did such a good job and saved the tour for us.
Well, I mean, I've read where he was the one that gave he best the bad news that he was no longer in the group, and he really tried to ease it over. From what I understand, he said, I'd be interested in managing a band that features you, Pete. You know, it just that doesn't strike me. Everything that I've ever read about Brian Epstein is that he was a very kind, very very gentle soul, and it just seems completely out of character.
I think so. I think it was in Nickel's mind, the whole blacklisting concept.
Yeah.
Couldn't find anybody that could support it. The only thing I could find is that he had been in a band called Vince Eager and the Quiet Three, and Vince Eager said, well, you know, possibly he got the concept or the idea from the fact that I, Vince Eager, had in fact been blacklisted by my manager, Larry Parnes. And it's well documented in British music history that for 2 years, Larry Parnes said, you're not going to play anywhere because we've had this disagreement, and he didn't play anywhere. So it's possible that impressionable young Jimmy Nickel got the idea from the Larry Parnes-Vince Eager incident and applied it to himself, instead of maybe turning inward and saying, maybe I went wrong, maybe I did some things wrong in my solo career.
Accept some responsibility yourself.
Right.
So, Jim, a couple people have said, he was just a fill-in. So my point is, what enticed you to write a book about a substitute drummer?
I guess as a Beatle historian, I was always fascinated with the fact that he only got one sentence in music history. He's a really talented guy, never mentioned in any British music history books, and only given this one sentence. And it was really just basically curiosity. I had these questions, which was, well, where did this guy come from? Why was he chosen? Why was he able to fill in so easily? I had to learn about these things, about how he knew the songs ahead of time and where that came from. What did he do to deserve to be one of the potential candidates? Then I wondered, well, what must it have been like for an everyday guy who one day, no girl's even looking at him, and the next day they're tearing his clothes apart to get at him? Imagine what goes through your mind where, you can walk down the street of London, no one even cares about you. The next day you're in a limo, you get out with the Beatles, and they're tearing your clothes off and pulling your hair and wanting to kiss you, and they all come up to the hotel room, and they want to do a lot of other things, which you'll have to
read. Oh, that doesn't happen.
Happens. It's all in the book.
Never.
But imagine what that's like. So I thought, I've got to, learn about every single day of this tour and talk about what it was like to be in the inner circle of this crazy Beatlemania.
Yeah.
And then, finally, my curiosity was, well, everyone says, and then he faded away into obscurity. You know, it's like part of the one sentence on his life, and it's what you read online. But in fact, he had a very interesting and successful and varied career after the Beatles. And I thought, well, it might be kind of fun to try and follow where he would vanish each time, where he would end up again after that. And I found this guy composed movie soundtrack music. He taught at a technical college. He taught music theory. He was a radio host like you guys. He had his own in Mexico, one of the places he vanished to for about 10 years. He created his own button factory. Now, for years, I had seen little mention of this, and I thought, what are you doing making, you know, buttons for shirts? What's that all about? And it turns out it wasn't that. It was the buttons that many people used to wear in the 60s and 70s that would have, say, peace symbols on them or your favorite group or something, you know, that communicated something about who you are because you wear that button.
Sure.
So not only did he manufacture those buttons, but he also would go around to stores throughout Mexico City and distribute them to the stores himself. And the other interesting thing he did without any licensing permission from the Beatles is he would rip off pictures and, you know, Yellow Submarine animation and things like that and create some buttons out of that.
Make bootleg stuff.
Bootleg buttons.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, now, Jim, I do have a question. With all the research that you've done, do you have any thoughts or an opinion as to why another band, or if he didn't start up another band being a part of the Beatles for the short amount of time that he was, why he wasn't picked up being as talented as he was?
Your question got cut off.
You can't hear me? Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. I was asking if you had any thoughts or opinions why Jimmy, being as talented as he was, why he didn't become part of another group or another group didn't pick him up, being a part of the Beatles amount of time that he was.
He did play briefly with Peter and Gordon, but chose not to become a permanent drummer with them. He played for 2 years with the Spotniks, where he was a permanent member of the band, but then he got into some heavy drug use, and I think he, based on interviews with that band, he felt that he was perhaps a little bored or stale because their music wasn't as complex as his own. And then he formed groups in other countries as well, but they were sort of surrounding him as the person that would create the music, would write it, would compose it, would pick the arrangements and things and do it all himself. And frankly, these weren't world-beating albums. He never cracked the charts with music that he chose to put out there. So I think part of it was, once he had been a Beatle, he couldn't go back to just being in somebody's band and not sort of being in charge. He felt that as the, quote, fifth Beatle, he could somehow compete with the Beatles himself and that he would be the center of it. And, you know, look at something interesting in today's music world as a comparison. Dave Grohl was a drummer in Nirvana, and if he had stayed a drummer, he might have just sort of slowly gone off into obscurity. But instead, he picked himself up, he learned the guitar, he wrote music, and he's now the front man of the Foo Fighters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he didn't try to do it from behind the drum kit. And it's very difficult, I think, to be the star of any band if you're way in the back behind the drum kit.
Well, Phil Collins, wasn't he a drummer?
Yeah, he
absolutely was.
Yeah.
There you go.
So he went off on a start. He didn't start out as the front man of Genesis.
Right.
That was Peter Gabriel, and he kind of picked up the reins after Peter left the group.
Right.
But wow, what a gig! You know, it's an amazing. I mean, it really is an amazing story. But it seems like maybe Jimmy's expectations were just a little bit too high into the stratosphere. You know, I mean, I think had I had this gig, I mean, first off, in 2013, if somebody was going to offer me $5,000 for two weeks worth of work, my jaw would hit the floor. I can't imagine what that would have been like, you know, almost 50 years ago. That's just unheard of. That was an ungodly sum of money back then. But, you know, I think I also would have had the common sense to ground myself and say, you know, this is fun. It's going to be over as soon as Ringo's back on his feet, and I just got to enjoy it while it's going and look back on it with fond memories.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great point. I do think it went to his head. I mean, look at the fact that he could have come back and worked for Georgie Fame, been in that band, which became an even bigger band after that time. They were on TV shows in England and America. They had big hits. And, in fact, that band is still going today as we speak.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. And also, at the same time, he could have continued. He would have been even more in demand as a session man in the studio.
Oh, yeah.
And back then, session players worked basically half a week and made three times as much income as the average British worker.
Wow.
So, I mean, he easily, again, if you put your ego on the shelf, he really could have
sounds like he did not.
Quite successful, financially anyway. And, you know, it went. You know, obviously, I'm sure his divorce was related to his ego. I mean, one of the first things he did with that money was he bought a Jaguar.
Wow.
And then racked up, like, speeding tickets and things. So, you know, imagine you have a wife and a child at home, and you're spending all this money on your band. And
come on, dog.
Well, you know, I was on television for three seasons. I was one of the stars of a show, and I knew that ride isn't going to last forever. You know, and I was one of the three primary stars on the show on every episode, and I was like, you know what? Enjoy this ride while you can, because it won't continue forever. And, you know, don't think that you're entitled to anything beyond this. You know, and every step of the way, I was like, you know what, this could end tomorrow. So just enjoy it while it continues and look back on it with fond memories. You know, it sounds like Jimmy couldn't do that. It sounds like his ego went to his head very, very quickly.
I think so. Well, and again, you know, he was at the top of the entertainment world.
Of course.
So it's hard for us to, you know, see what would happen if we had been put into that position.
Well, if it went to his head that quickly, do you think maybe he was thinking he was better than Ringo and they were going to see that and maybe actually replace him or replace Ringo with him?
He actually alluded to that in a... an unreleased interview from 1984. He went to a Beatle convention in Holland, and at that time they asked him, did you think you maybe would replace Ringo? And, you know, keep this in mind, Ringo had only replaced Pete Best after 2 years.
Yeah.
Now 2 years on, here comes Jimmy Nicol, and Jimmy, based on this interview, did have thoughts, well, hey, I think I'm a little better drummer, and I'm getting along really well socially with these guys. We're partying, we're laughing on the planes, all that. We're, you know, joking at the press conferences.
Yeah.
Maybe I am the next drummer. Only once Brian Epstein and Ringo returned, it was as if they closed the ranks on this inner circle, and now he was on the outside looking in.
Hmm. Well, when you put it that way, I mean, it's pretty easy to see how he might, you know, how it might go into his head. And you might think if he's getting along with these guys this well and everything's going great, that perhaps he would replace Ringo and that, you know, that it would just be that easy for it to go to his head because of that.
Yeah, it's really one of those things, you know, it did go to his head. In fact, Georgie Fame remarked in the book. You know, the whole Beatle to his head.
No.
Well, Jim, is Jimmy still alive?
Well, is this Jen?
Yes.
Or Julie?
This is Jen.
Jen, you'll have to read the book, The Beatle Who Bangs, to find out if Jimmy Nicol's
right.
alive.
Jen,
and
you
it
beat
is
me
available
the
at it's available at Amazon.com and TheBeatleWhoVanished.com.
Great. Well, my next question would have been: is he aware of the book, and did he have any input into the
well,
book's
that
content.
Well, that would depend on whether he's alive.
Yeah.
Okay. See,
you say
that's
that gives
why
it away.
I prefaced it.
Those are great questions.
Darn.
Where's
but
don't
my
think
notes?
I haven't.
Okay.
Don't think I haven't been asked those questions a few hundred times.
Cool. Good deal.
I was just at the
Jim,
Fest in New York, and I think close to 200 people asked that question.
Oh, no. Okay. Oh, well.
Well, Wikipedia doesn't say.
No, it doesn't say.
Well, and as, what did I tell you about Wikipedia?
About Wikipedia.
Yeah, true.
Don't trust a lot of what they say. You know, I think one of the things they say in there, too, is that George Martin had worked in the studio with Jimmy Nicol, and when I interviewed George Martin, he said, nope. He said it wasn't even possible because they were on different record labels with different studios, and you weren't allowed to cross-pollinate back then in the music world.
Interesting.
Lots of
well, Jim, what is next for you? Where will you be? Where can people find you? And where can I find the book again?
Well, let's see. What is next for me? I'm not sure. But I'm hoping to perhaps get a movie deal for the book because I've had some interest already. I think it would make an interesting film.
Well, we work for free. Tudor Chat Ladies work for free.
All right. We can all go down the red carpet together. And
well,
then people...
I
was just going to say people can find the book at Amazon.com or TheBeetleWhoVanished.com if they want a special signed and numbered edition.
Great. Thank you. Julia?
I was just going to make a comment, actually, something I was thinking of earlier when I was looking at a couple of pictures of Jimmy. I was going to say that, you know, if you do get that movie deal, I think Jim Carrey is almost a dead ringer for him with that same haircut.
Who is?
Jim Carrey.
Oh, Jim Carrey, yes, he's Dumb and Dumber.
I think you're right.
I think you're right, too.
Yeah.
If he's not,
totally
if he's not too
resemblance.
Old for it, but I totally see that.
Uncanny. Okay, new conspiracy theory. Jim Carrey is a Time Lord. That's what happened to him.
Oh, well,
exactly.
That's in the book on page 140.
Jimmy Nicol, Jim Carrey,
yep.
Coincidence? I think not.
I don't think so.
Same gap in the teeth, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
Although he is taller. Jim Carrey appears to be taller. Mm-hmm. But that could be
well,
a
we can
camera.
Make him shorter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. The camera angle.
Yeah.
Well, Jim, thank you so much. This has been a lot of information. It's wonderful.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed being on the show.
Absolutely. And next week, of course, we have... I think you're friends with Angie McCartney.
Yeah.
Paul McCartney's
oh, that'll
stepmother.
Be fun.
Yeah, she'll be
Paul's
on with
stepmom.
Us.
Paul's stepmom.
Yeah.
That'll be a good time.
Yeah. The well, tea lady. The
rock and roll Beatle time on Cougar Chat.
I did that on purpose. I put it all together. Beatlemania on Cougar Chat.
Very cool.
Well, Jim, tell everybody where they can find you on Facebook, Twitter, and all of that.
All right. Well... On Facebook, Jim Birkenstadt. I have a page also called Rock and Roll Detective, A-N-D, Rock and Roll Detective on Facebook. If you want to know more about my consulting company, it's rockandrolldetective.com. You can see about what I've done, what I can do. And then, of course, the book is available at Amazon.com. It's called The Beetle Who Vanished by Jim Birkenstadt with a special foreword by another temporary Beatle, Chaz Newby. And then at our website, you can see all kinds of cool video and listen to rare audio and see some rare pictures of Jimmy Nicol and read reviews about the book. And if you want your own signed, hand-numbered edition, go to TheBeetleWhoVanished.com.
Very good. I'm on it.
All right.
I'm buying it tonight on Amazon.
Great.
Well, Jim Birkenstadt, thank you so much for joining us. You're welcome to come back anytime and give us updates. And we will talk to you soon, and have a great week.
Sounds good. Thanks to you, Jen, and thanks, Julie, and thanks, Patrick. I really enjoyed being on the show.
Oh, thank you, Jim.
All right. Take care.
All right. Take
Bye-bye.
Care. All right.
Bye.
What a great guy.
Very informative.
Very, very cool.
Yeah.
Definitely done his homework.
Yes. Yes. Because that, yeah, that was one of my questions. I'm like, what entices you to write a book about a fill-in drummer? Yeah, you know? So.
Yeah, well, I don't, as he was talking, all I could think of was like, well, you're part of a band that's just that huge. I don't know. I just would have thought that he, you know, someone would have scooped him up the second that, you know, he was out the door with the Beatles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He must have had a huge attitude. I don't know. Just my.
Yeah, it sounds like, I mean, well, come on. Let's look at it. You're a footnote. You're with them for a little over a week. You know, you play 8 gigs together. I mean, how does somebody's ego get that big that quick? That's just kind of, it boggles the mind, really.
Mm.
You know, just count your blessings that you're getting the temp gig, the sit-in gig, to end all sit-in gigs. You know, but it just, you know, this is the thing, you know, and I'm probably going to insult a lot of people here as somebody who's been in a band. Drummers can be very, very difficult people to work with. It's been my experience over the years. Not saying they're all difficult to work with, but I've had some bad experiences with drummers in the past, and you know, they kind of do have a little bit of a chip on their shoulder because, you know, if your bass player doesn't show up, you can still, the guitar players and keyboard players can still rehearse. If you don't have any percussion, the rehearsal is over, basically. You know, it's not gonna, yeah, and they realize that they are the cornerstone of the band, and
kind of,
you know, I think, yeah, exactly. So
That makes sense. So they feel like they can come and go as they want.
Yeah,
or you can play
acoustically. Right. Well, yes. Now in this day and age, now that acoustic sets are now you know, all the rage. But back when I was in a band back in the 80s, that the acoustic movement as it is hadn't really started yet, so it was like there were a bunch of guys standing around with electric instruments, and it's like, where's our percussion? What are we going to do? You know, we would try to rehearse without a drummer, and it just sounded like garbage, so we usually ended up calling it a night pretty early back in those days. But yeah, man, it just an amazing thing, though. I mean, what a gig to have.
Well, we know from experience and phenomenology that all you need are 2, 3, 4 guitars, and you can play music all night.
That's true.
Absolutely.
Until Marley tells me, okay, go take Patrick's guitar away from him, and we can go to bed. Marley,
that
I know you're listening.
That was so funny.
It was great to
have
all that.
She's in the other room laughing. She's cracking up. Oh, that was so funny. It was what about? That was about 5 o'clock a.m. And we're like, running on just pure adrenaline at that point.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And Jen just very, very, very slowly just walks over to me, reaches down, takes the guitar from me, slowly turns around and walks away. And I'm like, I guess this means the gig is over.
Now, Patrick, was this mid, like during a song that she did this, or
no?
I think
we were in between songs. I think Jen let us finish playing, and she just very, very gingerly
funny.
Reaches over, removes the guitar from my hand, and turns and walks away. And I'm like, I think that means it's bedtime.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I know I was in the room when this happened. I don't know how I missed it.
Yeah, this is a lobby. Down in the lobby. Yeah. Well, Patrick, thank you for joining us, and please tell Marley thank you for letting you come on.
Thanks, Marley.
And give her a big
Absolutely.
Hug.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yes.
From both
sure.
of us.
It was a lot of fun, and you know, I'm envious of anybody that you know, has had any kind of connection to the Beatles, you know, you know, certainly his resume is very impressive in terms
yeah,
of what he's you know, the opportunities that he's had is just pretty amazing. To actually work with the Beatles organization themselves is just like you know, it's always a thrill for me anytime I get a chance to talk with somebody like that. So thank you, ladies, for having me on tonight.
Thank
and
you.
Well, absolutely.
You ever need a male cougar to fill in, let me know.
Well, if you want to come on for our next week's show with Paul McCartney.
Oh, I was hoping you were going to say that.
Oh,
I know.
On the subject of Paul McCartney, if we have time, Jen, I do have one question I want to get Patrick's perspective on.
Okay.
Regarding Paul McCartney.
We have about 5 minutes, just letting you know.
Okay. What do you think about the whole 1966 conspiracy, Paul McCartney's death? They were trying to...
Oh, my God. I must be psychic. I am having a psychic awakening moment. I knew you were going to ask me that. No joke.
How could I not? I mean...
You know, my whole take on that, the whole Paul is dead, miss him, you play the song backwards and you get the message, and 28F on the Volkswagen Beetle on the cover of Abbey Road, you know, he would have been 28 years old if he had lived. Interesting, isn't it, that they found not only a look-alike of Paul McCartney, not only a sound-alike of Paul McCartney, not only a left-handed bass player like Paul McCartney, but somebody who actually has musical talent to match Paul McCartney.
Right.
Sure. Okay, could possibly happen if they had a cloning machine in 1966. highly, highly unlikely. I do believe that the Beatles, because they knew how rabid their fans were, that they it was probably a concocted thing that they did just to see if fans would catch on to it and see how crazy it would go and how far they could take it, you know, because he's on the cover of Abbey Road in bare feet, and that's supposed to be a reference to how frequently back then, I guess, they buried corpses without shoes on, and he's holding a cigarette, a coffin nail in his hand. I mean, you can just keep going on and on and on with it. And it's certainly fun, and I think the Beatles themselves, they just did it for their own personal amusement to see, you know, how far will the fans take this, you know, if we just plant the seed.
Right, and I also remember them saying that if you look at earlier pictures of Paul and you compare them with pictures after the fact, that they don't match up. I remember reports of that as well. And
still looks like Paul to me. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. People age. People do drugs. People have bad nights.
Of course.
They look tired. People lose weight, gain weight.
Exactly.
You tour nonstop for 2 or 3 years, literally, you know, and it takes its toll on you.
Right.
And, you know, certainly people do age and they get older, and appearances do change over time. But, you know, there's a conspiracy nut for everything out there, you know.
We're nixing that one, though. It's not true.
Yeah.
Paul McCartney is alive and well. And we're going to talk to his stepmom next week, so...
Awesome. Well, I knew you'd have some great insight on that, Patrick, so I had to ask.
I love a good conspiracy theory. Unfortunately, that's not one of them.
Right. Oh, me too. Right.
Well, good deal. Well, Patrick, we will talk to you next week, same time, or same bat time, same bat channel.
Same bat channel. Let's do it.
Awesome.
All right, hon. Well, have a good week.
You too. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks, ladies.
All right. Bye,
Patrick.
Bye-bye.
Well, thanks for listening to our Beatles special with Jim Birkenstadt, discussing The Beatle Who Vanished, Jimmy Nicol, the drummer who filled in for Ringo Starr. Next week, be sure you tune in to hear us talk to Angie McCartney, the Tea Lady. She is Paul McCartney's stepmom. And then the following week, we have Mark Shinnock from the Vegas live show, Rock of Ages. I've actually just watched Rock of Ages, the movie with Tom Cruise recently. It was hilarious. I don't know if you've had a chance to see that, Julie.
Not yet.
It's pretty good. So we'll have him on. Everyone, have a great week. We'll talk to you next week. I'm going to take us out with a commercial. And find us on Facebook, Cougar Chat, Google+, Cougar Chat, Twitter, Cougar Chat Radio. And peace. Y'all take care.
Are you ready for ParaFest 2013? It's the paranormal horror convention that has it all. From Bigfoot to comic book men to ghost hunters, UFOs, vampires, and even zombies. Come meet your fan favorites from movies and television, including True Blood's Kristen Bauer, Sam Trammell, Dennis O'Hare, and William Sanderson. The Walking Dead's Michael Rooker, Iron E. Singleton, and Lou Temple. Supernatural's Mark Shepard, Ty Olson, Chad Lindberg, and the Sci-Fi Channel's Ghost Hunters and The Haunted Collector. We've also got Ghostbuster Ernie Hudson, Candyman Tony Todd, and many, many more. There will be celebrity Q&As, lectures and vendors, meets and greets, and even a celebrity ghost hunt. So please join us at the Sands Bethlehem Event Center in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, this September 6th, 7th, and 8th for ParaFest 2013. For more information, go to www.parafest2013.com.